The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the January 17th, 2025 issue of the Week. And we are in our first new issue of 2025. The cover this week is actually a combination of a photograph and a drawing. The photograph is of the January 6, 2021 rioters. The Trump folks are on one side of the barricades, and the Capitol Police are on the other side, and they're pushing them over. The drawing part has Donald Trump looking at the viewer, smiling, and he's holding a paint roller. He is rolling white paint over the photograph. He's got little splotches on his suit. The headline is Alternate History, How Trump is Whitewashing the January 6th Capitol Riot. That is our first main story, and we'll start right there. Congress certifies Trump win on January 6th anniversary. What happened? Congress certified President-elect Donald Trump's electoral victory this week, 4 years to the day after a violent mob he'd instigated tore through the Capitol in an attempt to prevent certification of President Biden's win. The calm proceedings were a striking contrast to January 6, 2021, when lawmakers ran for their lives as thousands of rioters stormed the building, ransacking offices, assaulting police with scaffolding pipes, baseball bats, and stun guns, and calling for the hanging of then-Vice President Mike Pence, who defied Trump's demands to overturn his 2020 election loss. The brief ceremony was presided over by Vice President Kamala Harris, who in her losing presidential campaign called Trump a fascist and a threat to democracy. Today, America's democracy stood, Harris said. Democrats demonstrated what fidelity to the Constitution looks like, said Representative Jamie Raskin, the Democrat from Maryland. But it was difficult to stomach after Trump's 4 years of lying about who had won in 2020. Biden told reporters that Trump's attempts to undo the 2020 election were a genuine threat to democracy. In a Washington Post op-ed, he called out the unrelenting campaign by Trump and his allies to recast January 6 as a peaceful protest. Trump, who has repeatedly vowed clemency for at least some of the more than 1,250 protesters convicted on January 6 charges, said major pardons are coming. Asked if he would pardon those convicted of violent offenses, including attacking police, Trump pivoted to criticizing the FBI, whom MAGA conspiracy theorists claim instigated the riot. We'll be looking at the whole thing, he said. What the editorial said. We cannot let the darkness of January 6, 2021 disappear into a memory hole, said the San Antonio Express News. It was no day of love, as Trump has claimed. Americans watched in horror as a mob shattered windows, attacked Capitol officers with the poles of American flags, and howled for Pence's blood. For a brief moment, we were united as a nation in our fear and disgust. But Republicans' outrage soon turned to denial and whitewashing, and now the chief instigator is returning to the White House. As Trump pledges pardons, a question looms, said the Wall Street Journal. How far will he go? Will he pardon Joshua Lee Atwood, who pepper sprayed and beat police he berated as pieces of S? What about Michael Bradley, previously convicted of meth trafficking, who swung at officers with a metal baton? For Trump to pardon such offenses would send an awful message about his view of the acceptability of political violence done on his behalf. What the columnist said. The battle of January 6, 2021 was fought with fists, batons, and riot shields, said Kyle Cheney and Nicholas Wu in Politico. Now a psychological battle is underway over GOP efforts to erase the harrowing reality of that day. Having spent 4 years recasting January 6 as a peaceful protest and amplifying lies that left-wing agitators or federal agents were behind the violence, Trump is readying pardons that will further entrench his revisionist version of the attack. Meanwhile, congressional Republicans who've embraced Trump's alternate history are vowing to go after former GOP Representative Liz Cheney and others who investigated Trump's effort to subvert the 2020 election. As a former Capitol Police officer, I'm still living January 6, said Aquilino Gonnell in the New York Times. I can't escape the horrific hours of that cold Wednesday afternoon when I was beaten and struck by raging rioters until covered in my own blood. Hearing Trump promise to pardon my attackers as the very Republicans whose lives I fought to save downplay the event is devastating. To rewrite history is the handiwork of authoritarians, said Timothy L. O'Brien in Bloomberg. GOP efforts to whitewash January 6 can't be allowed to succeed. Haven't they succeeded already? Asked Nick Cattagio in the Dispatch. Voters have returned Trump to the Oval Office with a hearty endorsement of the same Republicans who condemned him 4 years ago. January 6 is no longer seen as a unifying national trauma, but instead as a point of partisan squabbling. And Democrats who warned voters of Trump's threat have learned that defending democracy is a losing electoral message, less important than the price of eggs. It's proof of what modern populist propagandists can achieve. If Republicans can persuade most Americans not to care about a genuine coup attempt, they can do anything. The lesson will not be lost on them over the next 4 years. In a shorter main story, Trump proposes taking over Greenland, Canada. What happened? In a remarkable news conference this week, President-elect Donald Trump launched a series of audacious proposals calling for the U.S. to seize Greenland and the Panama Canal and saying Canada should become the 51st state. Speaking from his Mar-a-Lago estate, Trump suggested Canada could be compelled to join the U.S. through economic force, saying, Canada and the United States, that would be really something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line. But he explicitly refused to rule out using military force to acquire the other territories. It might be that we have to do something, he said, because those regions are vital to our country and critical for national security purposes. He also threatened that all hell will break out in the Middle East if Hamas doesn't release all remaining Israeli hostages held in Gaza before his inauguration. And in rambling tangents, he railed against weak water pressure and windmills and vowed to rename the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. Foreign leaders firmly rejected Trump's plans. Panama's government said the canal would remain in Panamanian hands, while Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said there was not a snowball's chance in hell that his country would become part of the United States. In Greenland, a self-ruling territory of NATO ally Denmark, Prime Minister Mut Egede said that the island was seeking independence and would never be for sale. Although Denmark's foreign minister, Lars Løkke Rasmussen, reacted more mildly, saying the Danes were open to dialogue. What the columnist said, thank goodness Trump is addressing things that matter deeply to real Americans, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. We voted for him just so he would snatch Greenland for us and bring down the cost of seal meat. Trump will make MAGA dreams come true as long as those dreams involve whatever he happens to be talking about on any given day. It's not insane to want access to Greenland, said Liam Denning in Bloomberg. The massive island, the size of Texas and Alaska combined, sits astride strategic sea lanes and is a potential trove of resources like oil, gas, and minerals. Still, exploiting those resources could be done at lower cost and risk by a targeted cooperation rather than calls to redraw maps. Only one person benefits from this endorsement of imperialism. Vladimir Putin, said Holly Elliott in CNBC.com. Russian pundits are already saying that U.S. annexation of foreign lands would validate Moscow's own expansionist ambitions in Ukraine. While Trump clearly believes strong countries have the right to bully weaker ones, his real motive for these threats is likely just fan service, said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. His agenda of tariffs and tax cuts for the rich is unpopular, so he needs drama to entertain the MAGA base. The bluster could have the effect, though, of provoking our allies to elect tough nationalists who will stand up to the U.S., a long-term cost to American foreign policy purchased for fleeting political gain. Controversy of the week. Congress. Can Republicans pass Trump's agenda? It's a mega, MAGA moonshot, said Mike Allen and Steph W. Knight in Axios. As the days tick down to Donald Trump's second inauguration, he and newly reelected House Speaker Mike Johnson have announced plans to enact the bulk of Trump's agenda in what the president-elect calls one big, beautiful bill. That multi-trillion legislative package would extend Trump's soon-to-expire 2017 tax cuts, overhaul the tax code, deregulate the energy sector, fund border security and immigration enforcement, and raise or abolish the debt ceiling, along with, presumably, unprecedented spending cuts to help pay for it all. Johnson says a mega bill could reach Trump's desks as soon as April, but buy-in is needed from Republicans in the Senate, where new majority leader John Thune had been planning a two-track approach, with an energy and border bill to be followed by tax reform. And Trump is sending mixed messages. A day after endorsing a single passage, he said he'd be open to splitting it in two. Going with one bill would be a smart move, said Yuval Levine in National Review. Johnson has a razor-thin two-seat majority in the House. Bundling Trump's agenda in one bill would greatly raise the stakes of breaking with the party for House Republicans, whose historical preference for infighting over legislating will likely be the primary constraint on what Trump's second presidency can achieve. Pitfalls abound with the one-bill strategy, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. The plan is to push it through using budget reconciliation, which lets the Senate pass bills by a simple majority vote, circumventing a Democratic filibuster. But reconciliation is for budgetary legislation only. The Senate parliamentarian could reject any bill that veers too far into immigration or tax policy, and GOP schisms on fiscal matters seem hard to, well, reconcile. In return for raising the debt ceiling, House fiscal hawks have demanded steep spending cuts that could alienate moderate Senate Republicans. Scrapping the ceiling is a complete non-starter. A two-bill strategy makes more sense, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, because haggling over a mega bill between GOP factions could drag into the summer. But the main thing is that there be a strategy. Republicans need to be coordinated, or it's going to be a MAGA mess. Coordination will be hard with such a weak speaker, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. Yes, Johnson retained the gavel on a first ballot vote last week, But 11 hard right Republicans initially withheld their votes in protest and later sent a letter expressing their sincere reservations about his leadership. Trump has Johnson's back for now, said James Downey in MSNBC. As with former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, Trump will use Johnson as a fall guy if his agenda founders, before tossing him aside and waiting for the next warm body to fill the post. The biggest obstacle to Trump's agenda is that it's really unpopular, said Josh Marshall in Talking Points memo. Set aside his likely unworkable demand for mass deportations, and Trump's agenda basically amounts to huge bonanzas for the super wealthy to be paid for with cuts to health care, Medicare, and probably Social Security. Does the GOP, in this populist moment, want to fight the 2026 midterms on a platform of more gravy for billionaires? While they dither over strategy, Republicans should savor these final moments before Trump's January 20th inauguration, said Ross Barkin in New York Magazine. Compared with the coming challenge of trying to enact the agenda of an erratic 78-year-old lame duck president, these are the days of wine and roses. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for rebels with causes after chess world champion Magnus Carlsen quit a tournament in New York City rather than change out of the jeans he was wearing. After organizers explained the tournament's dress code to him, Carlsen, 34, said the issue became a matter of principle for me. It was a good week for homecomings after Athena the dog, missing for 9 days from her Florida home, delighted her owners by ringing the doorbell at 2:30 a.m. to announce her return. I tried not to wake up the kids, said owner Brooke Comer, but the kids woke up anyways from the excitement. And it was a good week for prepping after Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg addressed reports that he's building a 5,000-square-foot doomsday bunker at his $270 million, 1,400-acre estate in Hawaii. Zuckerberg told reporters that the underground dwelling, which reportedly has blast-proof doors and food production systems, is just like a little shelter. It's like a basement. But it was a bad week for long goodbyes. After Mike Johns of Los Angeles nearly missed a flight home from Scottsdale, Arizona, because his self-driving Waymo taxi repeatedly circled the airport parking lot and refused to let him disembark. Waymo said Johns was not charged for the trip. It was a bad week for competitive eaters after dictator Kim Jong-un banned the consumption of hot dogs in North Korea. Any Hermit Kingdom resident caught enjoying the decadent U.S. staple risk internment in a labor camp. Finally, it was a bad week for historical accuracy after Mike Johnson, shortly before being sworn in as House Speaker, read aloud a prayer for the nation that he claimed Thomas Jefferson recited every day in the White House. The Thomas Jefferson Foundation said there's no evidence the third president ever said the prayer, and noted he likely wouldn't have delivered such a public prayer anyway because he considered religion a private matter. The title of the briefing this week is A Looming Nuclear Crisis. Iran is closer than ever to acquiring an atomic weapon. How will President Trump handle the threat? How close is Iran to getting a bomb? It could be just months away. Rafael Grossi, head of the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, reported in December that Tehran was dramatically accelerating its production of 60% enriched uranium, a short technical step away from weapons-grade level of 90%. The regime already has enough near-weapons-grade fuel for up to a dozen bombs, according to a recent U.S. intelligence assessment. Turning that material into a warhead to be fitted atop a ballistic missile might take 18 months. A cruder bomb that could be hidden in a cargo ship, for example, might be completed in about 6 months. Iran insists it has no interest in such weapons and that its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. But U.S. and Israeli officials suspect that after a year of military humiliations, Iranian proxy forces in Gaza, Lebanon, and Yemen have been devastated by Israeli assaults, and Iran's close ally in Syria, dictator Bashar al-Assad, has been toppled by rebels, the Islamic Republic may have decided that its survival depends on acquiring an atomic bomb. When good things happen, like Iran being weaker than it was before, there are frequently bad things lurking around the corner, said Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor. When did Iran start pursuing nuclear weapons? In the 1990s. But its clandestine nuclear program only became public in 2002, when an Iranian dissident group published secret documents detailing a vast uranium enrichment plant at Natanz and a heavy water plant in Iraq. Iranian officials said the facilities had no military dimension, and the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, claimed in 2003 to have issued a fatwa banning the possession and use of nuclear weapons. Western leaders were skeptical, and in 2006, about the same time the regime began covertly building the Fordo enrichment plant in a mountain near the holy city of Qom, the UN Security Council unanimously approved sanctions on Iran. Those sanctions were eased under a 2015 deal negotiated in part by the Obama administration, under which Iran agreed to enrich uranium to only 3.67% for the next 15 years and transferred 97% of its already enriched uranium to Russia. But in 2018, then-President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the international agreement, which he called a disaster and the worst deal in history. What happened next? Trump reimposed sanctions, crippling Iran's economy. He had hoped that Tehran would beg for a new deal and possibly end its military expansionism in the Middle East. Instead, Iran ramped up its nuclear program. It began enriching uranium to 20% in early 2021, and a few months later, enriched to 60% for the first time. After the long-running shadow war between Iran and Israel erupted into open conflict last year, with Iran firing missiles and drones at Israel, and Israel retaliating with airstrikes, a top advisor to Khamenei warned that Iran will modify its nuclear doctrine if faced with an existential threat. President Biden was presented last month with options for a potential U.S. strike on Iranian nuclear facilities should the regime push ahead with building a bomb, U.S. officials told Axios. The incoming Trump administration must now decide on how to counter the threat. What will Trump do? The president-elect has told Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he doesn't want an Iranian nuclear breakout on his watch, sources told the Wall Street Journal, but also wants to avoid all-out war with Iran. Trump's aides see two ways to achieve those goals. The first, which some are calling coercive diplomacy, involves ramping up sanctions and raising the military pressure on Tehran by sending more U.S. forces to the Middle East and selling advanced weapons to Israel. There are some signs that Iran might be open to talks. It approved Lebanese proxy militia Hezbollah's November ceasefire deal with Israel and is keen to protect its crumbling economy from further damage. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian hopes for equal-footed negotiations regarding the nuclear deal, and potentially more, Iranian Vice President Javad Zarif recently wrote. But Iranian officials have said they won't negotiate under pressure and won't unilaterally curtail their nuclear program. What's Trump's second option? Help Israel destroy Iran's nuclear program. Israel, which views the programs as a mortal threat, has already softened up potential targets. Its October 26 airstrikes eliminated most of the air defense systems around Tehran and key nuclear sites, took out a facility that makes ballistic missile fuel, and hit a small nuclear research site. U.S. assistance would be needed to fully destroy the program. The Fordo enrichment site is deep inside a mountain and is vulnerable only to the U.S.'s biggest bunker buster, the 30,000-pound massive ordnance penetrator, which would need to be dropped by an American B-2 bomber. Another bunker buster would be required to hit the underground Isfahan Research Center, where Iran is thought to store nuclear material. Anything can happen, Trump said last month of confronting Iran. It's a very volatile situation. Which course will he choose? It depends which voices in his administration prove more influential. Trump has nominated several Iran hawks to his cabinet, including Marco Rubio, his pick for Secretary of State. But his administration will also contain more isolationist officials, such as Vice President-elect J.D. Vance, who has said that war with Iran is very much not in America's interest. Yet Israel appears confident that Trump will have its back if it chooses to strike Iran's nuclear facilities. It looks very, very, very good, said Jacob Nagel, Netanyahu's former national security advisor. I think for the first time, I've crossed the 50-yard line on the question that Trump might even join us in something with Iran. And moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. COVID left us less prepared. The COVID pandemic that began 5 years ago may have actually left us in worse shape, not better, to respond to the next crisis, said Helen Branswell. Sooner or later, we will face another pandemic. Indeed, there is growing concern that the H5N1 bird flu, now affecting chickens, cows, and other animals, might evolve to easily infect humans. Unfortunately, public trust in health institutions has cratered since the COVID virus arrived in 2020. Federal health officials racing to minimize infections and deaths from a new viral illness in real time, as thousands died and hospitals filled, fumbled their initial messaging about mask testing and isolation periods. Science requires course corrections as new information is gathered, but much of the public decided health officials couldn't be trusted. The development of the mRNA COVID vaccine in less than a year was a freaking miracle, saving millions of lives here and abroad. But vaccine skeptics promoted the false claim that the new shot was insufficiently tested and unsafe. When another pandemic inevitably arrives, there is likely going to be strong resistance to vaccination, wearing masks, and social isolation. That could mean we will have to relearn the lessons of COVID the hard way. The GOP's sabotage of the IRS. The GOP's efforts to defund the IRS give away its fake populist game, said Jill Lawrence. For years, the GOP has repeatedly slashed funding to the agency, leaving it with antiquated technology, severe personnel shortages, and an inability to detect and collect nearly $700 billion a year in unpaid taxes, mostly from the very wealthy. But the Biden administration's 2022 Inflation Reduction Act provided the agency with almost $80 billion in new funding over 10 years to modernize its technology and hire needed staff. The IRS was able to significantly decrease call wait times, collect over $1 billion in tax debt for millionaires, and introduce a free tax filing tool. Yet in behalf of its donor class, the GOP has been trying to claw back the money ever since, cutting it down to $58 billion during the budget negotiations in 2023. Another $20 billion cut was included in a recent funding bill. Republicans like to play up fears about escalating audits on everyday Americans to justify weakening the IRS. But the reality is they're helping the nation's economic elite get away with tax cheating, resulting in a greater tax burden for working people and higher budget deficits for the country. This column comes from Venezuela. Have we become a failed state? Venezuela is starting 2025 under the worst possible circumstances, said Gonzalo González. We should be entering a new era of constitutional rule with the inauguration of a government headed by the person elected by the citizens last July. Instead, the true winner, Edmundo González Urrutia, was forced to flee to Spain under threat of arrest. And the regime that stole the vote and kidnapped the state is swearing in autocrat Nicolas Maduro for a third presidential term. After the second straight sham election Maduro has claimed to have won, Venezuelans now face a dystopian situation. The ballot box has been entirely eliminated as a reliable civic instrument for the allocation of power. Despite our vast oil wealth, Maduro's incompetent socialist machine has managed to collapse the economy. Rampant hyperinflation has rendered food and medicine scarce, and those Venezuelans who can move abroad have already done so. Unwilling to respect the will of the people and incapable of meeting their needs, Maduro derives his power solely from his control of security forces and his willingness to use them without limits in intimidating and repressing those who disagree with him. As he clings to office at all costs, there is a real risk that the humanitarian emergency will become chronic and structural. We could become another Cuba or Haiti. The last word, our in-depth article, no place like home. Jamie Kachua's friends and family in Georgia voted to deport undocumented immigrants, said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. Now he's scrambling to stay in the country. Rome, Georgia. His wife was spiraling into insomnia, and his children were afraid to go to school. So Jamie Kachua sought out the person he trusted most in a crisis. He sat at his kitchen table in rural Georgia across from his father-in-law, Sky Atkins, the family patriarch. Jamie, 33, hadn't seen his own father since he was 10 months old when he left Mexico in a car seat bound for the United States. It was Sky, 45, who had stood by Jamie at his wedding, helped him move into his first house, and stayed at the hospital overnight when one of Jamie's children was sick with pneumonia. "We have to prepare for the worst-case scenario," Jamie told him. "There's a chance we could lose everything." "Isn't that a bit dramatic?" Sky asked. "How? Help me understand." Jamie muted the football game on TV and began to explain his new reality as an immigrant living in the country illegally after the election of Donald Trump, who had won the presidency in part by promising to deport more than 11 million people lacking permanent legal status. Trump's aides were discussing plans to build detention camps and enlist the military to carry out mass deportations beginning on day one. Their local Georgia member of Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene, was saying she couldn't wait to see it happen. Jamie's best chance to become a legal U.S. resident was a new program for immigrants like himself, people who were married to U.S. citizens and had lived in the country for at least 10 years without committing any crimes. But just a few days earlier, that program had been struck down by a Trump-appointed federal judge. "There's nothing to stop them from rounding me up once he takes office," Jamie said. Sky had spent much of his adulthood preparing to protect his family in a crisis. He had learned survival tactics in the Army and had trained in hand-to-hand combat as a Georgia corrections officer. In the past few years, as he sensed the country becoming more polarized and volatile, he had built up a small collection of firearms and a cache of emergency supplies. He had been anticipating a moment when the government might rise up against his family, but this particular crisis was one he had helped to create. "I'm going to be straight with you," he told Jamie. "I voted for Trump. I believe in a lot of what he says." "I figured as much," Jamie said. "You and just about everyone else around here." "It's about protecting our rights as a sovereign country," Sky said. "We need to shut down the infiltration on the border. It's not about you." "It is about me," Jamie said. "That's the thing I don't understand." When Trump was elected for the first time in 2016, Jamie had been single and childless with no real attachments. Now his wife, Jennifer, was up all night on the computer researching the intricacies of immigration law and trying to hire a lawyer, even though they were thousands of dollars in debt. His seven-year-old twins were sorting out clothing so it would be easier to pack in an emergency. "I've never felt like a foreigner until now," he told Sky. "I'm not going to let anything happen that puts your family at risk," Sky said. "It already did," Jamie said. "All those criminals that Trump's been talking about, the rapists, the gang members, that's not you," Sky said. He had heard Trump say that he would deport the bad guys first and possibly show leniency to immigrants who had been brought to the country as children. "You deserve to be here," Sky said. "To me, you're basically American." "But I'm not," Jamie said. He had done whatever he could to pass as American ever since he was about five, when his grandfather first taught him some of the rules of assimilation in the Deep South. No baggy clothes, no bandanas, no lowrider cars, no accent, no speaking Spanish outside the home when he could help it. Instead, he became conversant in the language of Salvation and hunting rifles and Georgia Bulldogs football. He asked his teacher and later his bosses to say his name as Jaime, closer to the typical pronunciation, but as Jamie. His younger brother, who was born a few years later and as a U.S. citizen at a hospital in downtown Rome, used his government benefits to keep and kept getting into minor legal trouble. Meanwhile, Jamie had never broken a law of any kind. He worked 50 hours each week at a car dealership, drove below the speed limit, paid his taxes on time, and smoothed the creases out of books before returning them to the library. But no amount of adherence to the rules made up for the one he had broken before he was old enough to walk or talk. When his family drove him across the border because his mother had found work at a chicken processing plant outside Rome. More than 30 years later, his presence remained illegal. All he had was a temporary work permit because of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which protects some immigrants who arrived in the country as children from being deported. Recently, Trump had signaled a willingness to work with Democrats to help DACA recipients stay in the country as a matter of heart, but he also targeted DACA for cancellation during his first term, and his allies were continuing to challenge the program with a pending lawsuit that seemed destined for the Supreme Court. Jamie believed the only way to ensure his safety was by becoming a U.S. citizen. A lawyer had told him that he would first have to leave the United States, return to Mexico, possibly wait weeks or even months, and then risk detainment by re-entering the country with a legal inspection. Only then could he even begin to apply for U.S. residency, a grueling process that was based in part on a judgment of his character. Jennifer had begun collecting dozens of letters from people in Rome to help the case, and now she took out a folder and started to read a few to Jamie. "He strives every day to live as a man of God," wrote a leader from his church. "He has a deep integrity and a huge giving heart. Many of his customers only want to deal with him because he has the biggest smile," a coworker wrote. "He's been the friend I counted on going back to middle school." Jamie turned away from the TV and looked at her. "How many letters do you think we need?" "As many as we can get," she said, because maybe her husband could be saved by some of the same people whose votes had put him at risk. "What about Sky?" she asked. A few days later, Sky drove across Rome to visit Jamie and Jennifer and babysit his grandchildren. He brought along candy for the children and his go bag of survival gear, which had traveled with him everywhere for the past several years. It contained all the supplies he thought he might need to be self-sufficient in a power outage or societal collapse. Tourniquets, binoculars, knives, whistles, flashlights, water filters, fire starters, snake bite kit, firearm, slingshot, Bible. Sky pulled into Jamie's cul-de-sac and carried his go bag into the house. Nowhere could he sense the country's political tensions escalating like inside his own family. He shared a house with his father, but they hadn't spoken for 13 months. Ever since his father accused Sky of being a radical foot soldier for Trump. His sister-in-law was transgender, but Sky refused to use new pronouns or change the way he talked because, he said, he didn't believe in that PC crap. His wife, a Democrat, had briefly considered moving out a few days after the election, accusing Sky of betraying their Hispanic grandchildren with his vote. And now he was navigating another divide with Jamie, whom Sky said he cared for like a son. Sky had been skeptical when Jennifer first introduced him to Jamie, worrying that she would complicate her life by marrying an immigrant living in the country illegally. But Jamie had proved himself as a devout Christian, a great father, a model family man, Sky said. Jamie handed his one-year-old to Sky and told him about his latest long-shot plan before Trump took office: to travel to Mexico, wait for paperwork, re-enter the United States, and then apply for legal residency. "It's stupid that they make it this hard for someone like you," Sky said. "We agree," Jamie said. "I know it might not always seem like it, but I've got your back," Sky said. "I like Trump, but he's a blowhard. He's a salesman. He'll toughen things up on the border, but he's not actually coming after people like you. Nobody's putting you on a bus unless they get by me." Jamie and Jennifer drove out of Rome, past the MAGA souvenir stand, and toward the suburban Atlanta law office of Uriel Delgado. They gave him Jennifer's binder of evidence, the artifacts of a life in the United States, tax forms, school report cards, letters of support, car payments, mortgage documents, credit card bills. In Jamie's situation, Delgado said, the first step was to apply for advanced parole, essentially a travel document that would allow Jamie to leave the United States and re-enter lawfully. The wait time for approval could take anywhere from 6 to 24 months, unless Jamie had a reason to apply on an emergency basis, in which case he might be able to make it back into the country before Trump's inauguration. A lot of my clients might have a relative in Mexico who's sick or dying, Delgado said. They say they need to go visit, and that's how they get emergency permission. I don't have anything like that, Jamie said. My family's all here. No distant relatives that might have some kind of illness? No, Jamie said. Okay, what about a medical issue yourself? Maybe a dental problem, something where you need to go to Mexico to afford the treatment. Not really, Jamie said, and Jennifer sighed and nudged his shoulder. She knew that her husband sometimes cost himself a sales commission at work because he refused to exaggerate or take advantage of a customer. He believed in following the rules, even when they were stacked against him. We'll figure something out, Jennifer said. But what's holding us back is finances. What number should I be aiming for, like a total from now until he gets his green card? Let's see, Delgado said, and he took out a calculator and started adding up numbers. There were the government costs of renewing his DACA, $555, filing for advance parole, $630, adjusting his status, $1,440, and applying for a new work permit, $410. Then we have legal fees, Delgado said. I'm under market, but that's still about $4,500. And then there's my airfare, obviously, Jamie said. Right, Delgado said. And my airfare, Jennifer said. I'm not going to be separated, because if something goes wrong and they don't let you back in, her voice trailed off, and she started to cry. Delgado told them about his parents who immigrated from Mexico to Georgia as children and later were given amnesty under President Ronald Reagan. They worked in menial jobs, saved, and eventually managed to buy a building in the center of downtown Rome, where they opened a restaurant and a nightclub. It was a popular place, especially among the city's growing number of immigrants. But neighboring business owners kept creating new obstacles, challenging their liquor license, citing arcane building codes, filing noise complaints, and eventually resorting to outright racism by accusing Delgado's family of a far-fetched connection to a Mexican cartel. Rome police kept showing up at the restaurant. The city council got involved. Eventually, his parents decided to close the business and follow Delgado to Atlanta. Every time I drive up that way, I still feel this anger, this thickness in the air, Delgado said. I get that, Jamie said. It's a complicated place. It's that small-town mindset, Delgado said. Yeah, but it's not all bad, Jamie said. There's a lot of goodness underneath. You think so? Delgado asked. I hope so, Jamie said. And then he followed Jennifer to the car, started driving home. A version of this article originally appeared in the New York Times. The single obituary today is a full-page spread for Jimmy Carter. We may have just enough time to get it in. I'm going to give it a try. The president who became a Nobel-winning humanitarian, Jimmy Carter, 1924 to 2024. Jimmy Carter rose from peanut farmer to president, yet made his greatest mark after leaving the nation's highest office. The Georgia governor, a devout Baptist, was largely unknown before he ran for president as a Democrat in 1976. That outsider status, combined with his penchant for micromanaging and preachiness, led to friction in Washington, While foreign developments, surging oil prices, the Iran hostage crisis, tanked his popularity and doomed him to a single term. But Carter then embarked on the most consequential post-presidency in American history, winning administration at home, admiration at home and abroad, and setting a new standard for former leaders. He became the face of Habitat for Humanity, personally building more than 4,400 houses. His Carter Center oversaw democratic elections in dozens of countries. His diplomacy diffused tensions in hot spots around the world, and he all but eradicated guinea worm disease from the planet. The bond of our common humanity, he said upon accepting the 2002 Nobel Peace Prize, is stronger than the divisiveness of our fears and prejudices. James Earl Carter Jr. came into the world that was primitive by today's standards, said the New York Times. Though his father owned enough land in Plains, Georgia to make a comfortable living, the clapboard farmhouse he grew up in lacked electricity and running water. Yet his mother, a nurse, had a keen interest in public affairs, and with an uncle in the Navy, young Jimmy set his sights on Annapolis. A month after graduating from the Naval Academy in 1946, he married his sister's best friend, Rosalind Smith, who would become his trusted partner. As a naval lieutenant, Carter did graduate-level work in nuclear physics and served on a nuclear submarine. But after his father died in 1953, he resigned his commission to run the family farm, disappointing Rosalind, who had no interest in returning to Georgia. The Carters soon found their footing in local civic life, said the Washington Post. After serving two terms in the state Senate, Carter ran for governor in 1966, but suffered a demoralizing loss to staunch segregationist Lester Maddox. The next cycle, he wooed rural whites by praising Alabama segregationist George Wallace, only to execute a stunning political pivot once in the governor's office, declaring that the time for racial discrimination is over. As governor, Carter largely lived up to his lofty words, appointing more black and female officials than all his predecessors combined. Soon he was mounting a long-shot bid for the presidency, positioning himself as untainted by Watergate-era corruption. Coming in first among named candidates in the 1976 Iowa caucuses gave Carter a burst of publicity and of momentum. While there were major public doubts about the born-again peanut farmer, there were more about President Gerald Ford, who had just pardoned Richard Nixon. The New South Democrat eked out a win. Carter signaled his intention to be a humble, no-nonsense president by walking some of the route to the White House with his family on Inauguration Day, said Politico. And for a time, voters embraced him. He pardoned Vietnam War draft dodgers, installed solar panels on the White House roof, further normalized relations with China, and got the Senate to ratify a 1977 treaty that gave the Panama Canal back to Panama. His brokering of the Camp David Accords, in which he persuaded Egypt to recognize Israel in exchange for the return of the Sinai, still stands as a milestone of modern diplomacy. But Congress resented his unwillingness to do backroom deals and insistence on balancing the budget, and his disarmingly candid addresses to the American public came across as condescending. In his first televised speech, Carter wore a sweater and urged Americans to turn their thermostats down to 55 degrees at night to conserve energy. In another, the malaise speech, he admonished them for being wasteful. He wasn't helped by the antics of his brother Billy Carter, who tried to milk his proximity to power by registering as a foreign agent for Libya. Critics quickly pounced on the new president as a rube who was out of his depth. Then came the traumas that played out his last year, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. Days after Carter allowed the deposed Shah of Iran into the U.S. for cancer treatment in 1979, militant Iranian students seized the U.S. embassy in Tehran. They would hold 52 Americans hostages for 444 days. An attempt at a military rescue ended in catastrophe when one of the helicopters crashed, killing 8 soldiers. Soon after, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, and as part of U.S. sanctions, Carter made the extremely unpopular decision to boycott the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow. Meanwhile, Americans were facing rising unemployment, inflation near 15%, and lines at the gas pump that could stretch hundreds of cars long. With Republican challenger Ronald Reagan asking, "Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago?" Carter lost the 1980 election in a landslide. Minutes after Reagan was inaugurated, Iran released the hostages. Carter began a new chapter, said the Wall Street Journal, becoming the most active former president in modern U.S. history. Guided by their Baptist faith, he and Rosalynn devoted themselves to giving back, creating the Carter Center to promote peace, democracy, and health around the world. Until their 90s, the couple spent 1 week a year building homes for Habitat for Humanity. They also threw their energy into fighting diseases. In 1986, when they began a campaign against guinea worm disease, a painful affliction caused by a parasite, there were 3.5 million cases in Africa and Asia a year. Now there are only about a dozen. A kind of diplomat on call, Carter went on numerous missions to war zones or to negotiate peace accords for Republican and Democratic administrations alike, to Ethiopia and Sudan for George H.W. Bush, to North Korea, Haiti, and Yugoslavia for Bill Clinton. But he was also quick to openly criticize U.S. policies he opposed, such as the 2003 invasion of Iraq, and unafraid to anger foreign leaders, saying in 1989 that Panama's Manuel Noriega had rigged an election. Back in Plains, where he still taught Sunday school, he wrote 32 books, including memoirs, a novel, and many on politics, such as the controversially titled Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Diagnosed with liver and brain cancer in 2015, he was believed to have just weeks to live. But he endured and seemed to revel in the extra time he'd been granted, publishing a final book on faith in 2018. Both he and Rosalynn began receiving home hospice in 2023, with Jimmy outliving her by over a year and managing to cast a vote for Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris. Carter wrote in a 2022 New York Times op-ed that he feared that Donald Trump's lies had irrevocably damaged the nation. "Our great nation now teeters on the brink of a widening abyss," he warned. "We are at genuine risk of civil conflict and losing our precious democracy." And that is all the time we have, not the usual outro. I'll see you next week.